You're listening to the Lean Built Podcast. I'm Jay.
And I'm Andrew. In this podcast, we discuss our manufacturing companies, lean principles,
and the freedom that we're pursuing in life and business.
So what's new?
Oh man, heavy news. So the chairman of my business roundtable group called Convene passed away yesterday.
I'm sorry.
Which is, it's tough. I was just reflecting. I've been in the group for about, what would it be, 6, 7 years, something like that. And he was just short of 80 years old. So he's got just decades and decades of experience and wisdom, and it's irreplaceable. His name's Bill Conine. I had a breakdown because he was, in a lot of ways, I was closer to him than I was any of my grandparents because of the relationship. We had this regular rhythm of pretty much our roundtable discussions the third Wednesday of every month, and the fourth Wednesday we would have 2-hour lunch. He talked me off the ledge a few times, and I wrote an email to him before he passed away just thanking him and just saying every time we'd leave our lunch, I'd walk away with the spring of my step, a plan in place, and some encouragement. Then you'd go execute it, and then you'd come back and you'd be like, wow, that was great. And just the way he approached it, some of the things that I appreciated most about him were that I'd lay out something that was very frustrating to me, and then he'd just look at me and just go, I'm sorry, Jay, I don't have anything to say. And I go, okay, this is good. I don't want just a fluffy bumper sticker answer. I want him to think about it. And sure enough, he'd call me a few days later. Hey, I was thinking about it. I went through this scenario and it's pretty similar. Just wanted to see if that might help. And I'm like, ah, it's like that grandfather type wisdom is just, it's irreplaceable. Our group of about a dozen of us, it's a tough week, but that happens in life. And certainly he's left a legacy that I just want to aspire to just doing the same at some point in my life of coaching and influencing people. Yeah, just working through that.
Did you have a chance to see him at all?
So I was sick last week. I thought, I don't want to go over there and get him sick, but he was on hospice. Mm-hmm. I should have just gone and seen him. It's crude, but yeah, if I got him sick, he would have passed away with a cold. So I did not get a chance to see him recently, but I did see him several weeks earlier, and we just had a really sweet time. He and I, with his wife and his younger sister in his den and his home. He was in the record industry, and he had all these, he was just a record industry guy. And so he had gold, platinum records in his office and these CD cover art album covers of just all over. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you worked with these artists? I had no idea. So the turnout at his funeral is probably going to be pretty significant. He was just such a humble man that he never dropped names. And so it was fun for me to spend a couple hours at his house just walking around. And his wife was giving me tours, and I feel terrible for her. They met in fifth grade.
And oh man.
Yeah. So from fifth grade to about 79 years old. Yeah. And just the whole thing was just, I had my best years with him when he was healthy. And so I missed the last few days of his life. I'll still cherish the years before that for sure.
That's good.
Yeah. So
I lost a friend a couple of weeks ago and I went and visited him. He was on hospice, and a man named Curtis Cook, who I went to church with for years and years. And I took my wife and a couple of our kids with us, and we went and saw him, and he was fighting hard.
Wow.
He was working hard.
Yeah.
But it was very good.
Yeah.
To see him only for a few minutes, tell him we loved him.
Yeah.
Thank him for his friendship and his care.
Mm. Yeah.
It's really good. When I think about what I want in terms of legacy or to be remembered for my business, it's not that I did this or that cool thing or had that sweet video on Instagram that got tons of likes. I want the work that we do, the company we build, the family that I raise, to care for people, to provide for people.
Yep.
And no one is going to remember your feed rate. Everyone's going to remember when you helped them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. For me, death is such a great motivator. I heard a quote that I've stolen and tweaked over the years where, you know, no multimillionaire lays on his deathbed thinking, I am so glad I have ruined relationships with my adult children, multiple ex-wives, and people that scream and hate me till their dying day. The money was worth it. No one says that, and death is a great equalizer among mankind. And so for me, it's like, how do I want to die? I want to die with having lived a legacy of making people's lives better. One of my personal mission statements is, if people cross paths with me, they will better off having crossed paths rather than not. And that's just, I want to provide that value just in every way. It's motivating as a business owner, as an employer, but even like working with fifth graders in a small classroom just once a week, all that stuff, it ties into the greater purpose of at least my life. If there's anything that I would want to pass on, is just to get people to think like, what I'm doing right now, am I working on something that's really, truly worth it? There are some menial tasks in life, but the big picture stuff, the time that we dedicate our thinking to, is it worth it?
Yeah. Like the guy's in the hospital bed and, you know, the nursing assistant's like, what? And he's like, I'm so glad I answered all those emails.
Absolutely.
No.
Absolutely. That is so true. Well, I didn't want to kick off this podcast with the downer, well, but it's at least worth
variety is worthwhile. And in college, I bought a hard copy of the complete cartoons of the New Yorker.
Uh-huh.
And those kinds of, like, you know, the doctor leans in and the guy in bed's like, retweet me. Like the kind of humor that is where we actually live.
Yeah.
And it's important to be honest about how weird and messed up a lot of the stuff in our environment is.
Yep.
A few highlights here recently.
Yeah.
We continue to do a bunch of lean improvements, and actually we made a change just this week to our morning schedule, and it hasn't really picked up momentum yet, but I'm excited about it. I'm hopeful about it. And the change is very simple. Normally in the morning, we 3S for 15 minutes and then have a morning meeting and then hit the shop floor and enter production.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have consistently found is that 3S is a lot of sweeping, a lot of sorting, and very little standardizing and improvements.
Sure.
It turns into leaning is cleaning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so what we've done is we've switched it so it's now 15 minutes of 3Sing, focused primarily on cleaning, then a shorter morning meeting with a particular chunk on one of the wastes.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't need to be a different waste every day. We can focus on one waste for a week and talk about it. And then before we hit the shop floor for production, 10 minutes of improvement time.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody is doing anything else. Nobody's cleaning. Nobody's starting work. Everyone's looking for opportunities for improvement. Mm-hmm. And because nobody else is doing anything else but improvement, you don't have to worry about interrupting anybody else's work. Mm-hmm. Everyone is just looking for opportunities for improvement.
Yeah.
And my hope for that is that particularly now that we've got more than a dozen people in every morning meeting, because we have some part-timers who are here some days and not others, but every day we have at least 12 to 15 people in the morning meeting. We have some people who are up to speed and making improvements every day, coming up with ideas, recognizing waste. And we have others who very rarely suggest or implement any improvements. In some cases, nothing for a month or months. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I really want those people to have the opportunity to be riding along with somebody who's doing improvements every day and say, okay, for the next few weeks, for our 10 minutes of improvement time, I just want you to ride shotgun with so-and-so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just tag along, watch what they're doing, ask questions, help them do whatever they're working on, but have there be some structure besides, hey, excess motion is a waste. Go find some waste and improve it. Just say, no, we're going to do it the buddy system. I'm going to pair you up with somebody who already knows the ropes, already knows the verbiage, the concepts, already knows how to make improvements, and have you just ride along in the second seat.
Yeah.
And see what they do, see what they fix, see how they, and have them teach you, have them show you.
By example. Yep.
I'm really excited about that.
I've got some thoughts on that because going back to, man, it was one of our first few episodes, maybe episode, could have been episode 1, 2, or 3, something like that, but where we talked about the 6 types of working genius.
Yep.
And I think I have a higher awareness because of that, because I gave it to everyone in the company and we went over the results and we created a team map. And there were, to review, there's 6 different types of working genius, starting with wonder, then invention, then discernment, Then galvanizing, enablement, and tenacity. And it's the process of which an idea is first identified through wonder and then taken through everything so that a team can output product through tenacity. And what we found in the team map is I'm the only person in the company with the working genius of invention. And so for me, I think some of the frustrations I had over the years is, man, why doesn't this person create more standardized things? Or why aren't they? But they just aren't gifted that way, or they can do it. Everyone has capacity to invent and create, but they don't necessarily have the confidence to think, maybe I should do this. And we would try and normalize failure and just, if it's worth doing, it's worth doing poorly. I love that phrase. And so for us, it's, I realize I need to let off the gas on that one when I expect guys to make improvements. Now there's other guys that maybe they're not inventing improvements, but man, they can fine tune them or provide good feedback. Hey, we tried this. You tried it that way? Oh, I would have never thought about that. And so there's that feedback loop. And okay, let's go back to the inventor and redo this. And you know, that evaluation, that assessment is not quite accurate because two of my guys, John and Alex, who are like kind of like the mill lead and then the prototype machinist being John, they're both very inventive and they also have the gift of wonder. Like, could we do this better? In fact, they're the two guys in the company that have the genius of wonder, where they're going, gosh, there's got to be a better way. Those are the two guys that I've identified that do that, or the assessment has. And I'll be walking by and, hey, check this out. I want to try and figure this out. And so then I come in and I interject my invention and then they run with it. And then it gets to the end with someone, I don't know who would, but there was a large list of people with the working genius of tenacity, like 8 out of 10 guys in the company. And that's what you want in production, in a production environment, people that want to get things done. That's why I want to see how that works out for you. Because you haven't given your team the whole test, right? The assessment?
No.
Yeah.
No.
It'd be interesting too. I think it's worth the $25 a head.
So I've given a few of them that assessment. Mm-hmm. We recently did, are you familiar with Culture Index?
No, not enough to articulate it.
Similar-ish. It looks at people's work styles and personality types and helps understand what they focus on, where they're strong. And then it's basically two side-by-side assessments that look at their natural giftings and personality and then look at how they interpret the role they're in the company.
Mm-hmm.
And what was really interesting about that is you will always find some amount of mismatch where a person's like, well, I'm fairly introverted, but my role requires a lot of face-to-face people contact, whatever. And understanding the delta between what the assessment says about their personality and their style and their work type and what they think the job requires of them is a really interesting thing.
Yeah. Wow. Where can that be found? Is it a book tied to it or?
One of the guys I'm in Vistage with, my Vistage chair, does Culture Index assessments. I actually don't know a whole lot else about it.
Okay. That's interesting. I'll look into that.
I will look it up.
Okay. Yeah.
For next time.
Yeah. Some other fun things. Let me ask you this. We have a kind of a significant position that's opening up. Mm-hmm. I don't know, like you've always hired through Indeed, right? You've posted jobs there.
We've hired a lot through personal contacts though.
Yeah. Yeah. For us, it's the majority is personal actually. Yeah. We've interviewed a lot of people through Indeed, but we end up going with the personal contact.
Touche.
Gosh. Our process is that we create the job description. We post it. It still goes on Indeed. And then we point people to it so they can go through the same funnel.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, so that we're big on process around here, but I suppose I can make an announcement that we're hiring an applications engineer, which is fun stuff, and it can actually be remote. So if anyone's out there,
is that robotics automation integration or writing code or what?
No, it's even more simple than that. If you've worked in front of a mill and you are all on board for palletized work holding or fourth axis work holding or vacuum work holding, oh, those are our products. We just have a lot of email and phone and email traffic that we really want to just hire for that position and hire well. So the ideal
candidate, a person to develop turnkeys or a person just to field questions?
That too, primarily the questions, but that you can typically knock out in a couple hours per day. And then we turn down a decent amount of turnkey applications because we either don't have the capacity or it's something that we're not sure would work. maybe it's some exotic material or it's some odd shape that it's just not worth our time. And the customer's saying, hey, I don't want to do this either. Can you float me a quote? This is almost where you have to charge for your quotes because some government contracts do that. They pay contractors to provide quotes because they're that in depth. That's one of those things where we would probably say, yeah, okay, we'll quote this. And you might burn an hour of your day creating something that never turns into an order. But we definitely just know that it's a role that I should not be doing, Carlos should not be doing, some of my junior guys should not be doing. We need a guy with 5 to 10 years of experience in the industry, knows what a good cut sounds like, knows how to work with miniature clamps. If they use our products in a previous job, even better. That's icing on the cake. And of course, you need to know CAD/CAM, ideally Fusion, that type of thing. So yeah, it's and you can work remote. That's the best thing. So we're in California. Weather's perfect. If you're in the northern regions and you fit, we'll work with you.
Interesting.
Yeah. But the next step I would probably do is put out a YouTube video, but our videos get good, decent amount of traction. So could we get 100 resumes? Maybe. How do you manage that? So I don't know. How many applicants do you get when you do an Indeed?
It really depends. If we're advertising an entry-level position where it's on-the-job training, no prior experience, just need to have reliable transportation and show up on time, we probably get 30 or 40 and interview 3.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds right.
Mm-hmm. And of those 3, it's like 2 maybes and 1 no.
Yeah. So you're near a college town. Does that influence your local economy?
It bends light. It warps the earth.
Yeah.
The college town means that there are an extraordinary number of short-term gig economy workers, people looking for server jobs. And it's just a whole different set of businesses in a college town that would not exist if the college were not there.
Yeah.
But the more salient factor that we've noticed is that we have several big medical companies in the area, like Cook Medical, Cook Pharmaca, Catalent, and Boston Scientific. Mm-hmm. And those companies ballooned up during COVID, Catalent in particular, because they're a vaccine manufacturer. Mm-hmm. And they just had absurd amounts of federal subsidy, and they just sucked the entire local labor market dry.
Wow. Wow.
But since then, as demand for those vaccines has dropped precipitously, they've had multiple rounds of layoffs of 500 to 1,000 at a time.
Jeez.
And so there's been this revolving door of a lot of people got pulled in and were there for a year or two and are now getting spit back out. Mm-hmm. And we have a number of employees who worked at one or multiple of those companies in previous years. And I don't even know how to approach that because those companies are so big, and when they spin people off, they spin off so many people at once. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, if a local company that you knew laid off 5 people, how hard is it to pick the best candidate out of those 5? Mm-hmm. Well, not super hard. If a local company laid off 600 people today, how hard is it to pick the best candidate? It's impossible.
Yeah.
Like, you can't even interview them all. I have no idea how to start.
Right, yeah.
But there's no question that when a company lays off 500 plus people in a week, that there's some people in there that are awesome. Mm-hmm. And if you could identify them, you would hire them.
Right. Yeah.
Take any 500 people who are gainfully employed for a year or more. Some of them are awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just super hard to actually identify them.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Or even attract them to your posting, because you are competing on at least a regional level, if not national level. Yeah.
I don't know. I have never relocated for a job. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much people treat relocation for a job as normal versus it being an extraordinary measure that would be reserved only for an extraordinary opportunity.
Right.
Yeah. Whether that was a total alignment of passion with opportunity or amazing salary or some other bonuses, like I get to live in the mountains in Colorado and it's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. I don't know.
Yeah.
There are things that align for people to make them willing to relocate. Mm-hmm. But most people, very reasonably, will not relocate mm-hmm. for a run-of-the-mill job, nor should they.
Yeah. Yeah, we face that. I don't anticipate people relocating to California. It's always been for years or decades. It's been a place where people go to. But there's an exodus from the state. And then even when people will meet neighbors or random people around that have relocated from, like one couple, they relocated from Texas to here in Simi Valley. And my first question is, why? This is the wrong direction. Like, your U-Haul, was it free? You know, that type of thing. And it's typically, this is just a stepping stone. In fact, that's what he worked for, a big insurance company. And he moved out here to just take a position that needed to be filled because he knew it would be a stepping stone in this giant Fortune 500 company that he was in. They made their money. They were here for 4 or 5 years and they went right back to Dallas. But for this, I would not want to relocate someone here unless they wanted to, if they really wanted the California lifestyle.
So here's the question.
Yeah.
How do you assess whether there is legitimate value in being on-site versus remote?
Yeah. I think it would come down to the breakdown of, okay, so if you're banging out emails and answering calls, no, that can be done anywhere. But if you're out on the shop floor and we have some surge production and you just want to stand in front of a machine for a little bit, great. Or if you want to back up and put the finishing touches or put the starting line in front of Alex or John so that they can run with it. Great. You should probably be here. But arguably, the design work can be done remote too. So no, there's not very much utility to this particular position being here on site.
Okay. Let me ask a follow-up question then. Mm-hmm. Can you onboard a person into a unique, distinctive company culture without them being on site for some period of time?
Ooh, that's a good one. So I have two guys that kind of work remote. One definitely remote. He's out of San Antonio and he worked for us for 2 years, two of his 5 years, I think, before he moved out there. So he understood the culture and our culture's changed too. And so he zooms into our morning meetings.
Okay.
Yeah. We're talking about like time to 3S and I'm working in my office, my home office.
So even that question of, if you have remote workers, do you Zoom them into your morning meetings?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. They have to.
And so if you, for this remote position, a non-negotiable is you are available by Zoom in Jay's time zone mm-hmm. for morning meetings.
Yep. You know, I really do think that if we did do a hire, they would come out and work here for a week, if not 2 weeks. And we put them up in a hotel room. We onboard them. We do all that stuff. And then we send them back home equipped if they need equipment and stuff like that, computer stuff. Yeah, but I would say, yeah, it's imperative that you touch home every now and then, if not every 6 months. Some of the sales guys, they're always flying back to Chicago or they're going overseas to the factory at least once a year, maybe every other year. That seems like a good practice. Just I haven't had to tackle that through brain power yet.
Yeah. So for us, if we hired remote employees, that would be totally new territory.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an interesting conversation with Justin from Area 419 a couple weeks ago, and they have grown and grown in an incredible way.
Yeah, it's impressive.
And they're a shop that I look at and go, wow, that is spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing they've been super intense about is they're never going the two shifts.
Really?
Not doing it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the reason was, the second you have two shifts, you have two companies sharing the same building, was his explanation of it. That if you want to maintain a consistent company culture, you cannot have two tiers. Mm-hmm. You can't have second class citizens mm-hmm. in the company.
Yeah.
And unless you put your meetings in a swing shift position at the end of first shift, start a second shift,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't actually make much sense,
mm-hmm.
then you end up with a separate, independent, parallel company, separate culture.
Yeah.
And so they've been investing enormous amounts of time and resources into automation
mm-hmm.
so that their machines can run overnight, lights out, unattended. The loading systems that they've got for their Grobe G350s are mm-hmm. amazing.
Mm.
all robots loading Lang mini vices, and the mini vices are where the jaws with a robot grips.
Yeah.
And so you can change out whatever workpiece size fits in the vice. Mm-hmm. And then the only thing that's altered in the tray is which pocket positions have a vice in them.
Mm-hmm.
And the robot just, the stock size says we can only fill every other pocket. The robot picks up every other pocket, drops it in the machine, and off you go.
Yeah. Side note, that's the only way to do that type of automation. Do not interact with the workpiece. Interact with a known origin, a pallet, a cleat, something like that. Yeah.
Okay. Go into that.
Yeah. Okay. One of the learning curves that we had with the... Now, if you know my backstory, I bought a UR10 in 2012 thinking it would replace my employee. The media said automation is here to take jobs. Great. This guy shows up half the time. A robot could do his job.
Take his job.
Yeah. Not true.
I'm in your base taking your jobs.
So it's not true because robots are not creative. A lot of them are blind. They don't often have good tactile. At least the UR10 that I had back in 2012 did not have like load sensing, that type of thing. Maybe it did. I just don't remember. And there's part variation. You could have non-variation in parts, but you could have a chip that messes up placement of the parts. We were using it for these flat panels that go on the bottom of a vacuum chuck, so we call them bottom plates. And sometimes two bottom plates would stick together, like gauge blocks that are rung together.
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah, and an operator, it'd be easy. You just go, oh, that's easy. But it's high volume, low profit margin parts that's perfect for robots. And so interacting with the parts themselves has always been problematic. Now, we still do it to this day. We just have a little bit better technology. We have a camera that picks up pallets because you don't want to palletize a pallet. It's just too big of a... The payload is one thing, but you can actually pick it up. If people haven't seen our video, we have a cart of raw sawn blanks. It goes in and it starts from a known starting Z positive, moves Z negative until it finds about some like 5 newtons of load. And then it goes, oh, I reached the top of a part, turn on the vacuum, pick it up. Then you place it on this table that takes an image of it. Now it knows the dimensions and the location of the part. It identifies it, it picks it up in the center, geometric center, drops it off in the machine. That's worked great. Until it doesn't work because there's an anomaly with the lighting. There are some odd burrs. The saw was just a little bit, I don't know, I'm speculating. We just don't know. Sometimes it does and it doesn't work. Or the program, just we upgraded what's called the internal software. And now the program doesn't work like it used to. So there's so many problems that you can have with automation. That was one of the videos that I did back in November we released. It was the Pursuit of Peace. Through automation. So for us, it's when I see these, if you look at any independent robotic integrator, they're always going to the robot interacting with a known pickup point, typically a cleat, and that's attached to whatever fixture, whether it's a pallet or directly to a vise, something like that. But you don't want to work with the individual parts. Now, I know Haas has their auto pallet loaders, which they do pick up parts. More power to them. It's definitely the harder way to go because of the human factor not being there, the variation, the part factor, and just the chip factor. Chips are pesky. They get everywhere you don't want them to go. And does a robot know that it perfectly blew out chips? No. And so all those factors come into consideration when you go to automation. For us, no, it's we don't want to interact with the workpiece. We want to interact with a known platform or a pallet in which a human has then hand loaded the workpiece onto that pallet or workpieces, which is our Max 4 rotary pallet system. It's exactly why we created it because we want to repurpose our UR10 to work with a pallet of 12 parts. And there's 4 pallets so we can run those parts unattended because that's where we're going as a company. Single shift.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Long term.
So when it comes to automation, the devil is deeply in the details.
Yeah. And that devil surfaces in the worst ways, in the most dramatic ways. When you think the part has been properly loaded by the robot and then it goes to take its first cut and you've got a part through the window. So,
hasn't happened to us.
Okay.
Say it ain't so.
Full disclosure, hasn't happened to us, but it could. So,
Well, I had an interesting conversation today about detuning CNC cycles. I had a guest in my shop and it was checking out my various single piece flow work cells at R450s. And in our normal shell trimming process, we engrave brand and model information, we drill some holes, we interpolate some slots, and then we come out and cut out the outside perimeter of the part to finish it out.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked, which part of this takes the longest? And I said, unquestionably, the engraving is the slowest part of this, because it's just a lot of 2D contours to spell out a brand name and a model name and a number. It's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, we're really not that concerned about the cycle time here, because as long as this pallet finishes before the operator has the next part ready, it's gravy.
Yeah. But your times are really short too.
Oh yeah. Our detuned cycle times are 2.5 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. There you go.
But recognizing that we are consciously making the decision, we're doing human loading, verifying the vacuum, putting magnets on the part. I have no idea how robots would load magnets. Because the way you pick them up is by being ferrous. And the way you put them down is by putting them closer to something more ferrous than you.
Or you become non-ferrous.
Oh,
I was dropping magnets in a 3D print, and that was difficult as a human. So
yeah, if we start having controllable electromagnetic grippers for a robot to be able to pick and then free drop magnets onto a part, it's just, that's just crazy town.
Yeah.
Theoretically, totally possible. The physics and the electrical circuits, totally understandable. Actual implementation.
So it's encouraging to me to hear about what Area 419 is doing, because I've considered two shifts. We've gone to like a split shift, but the majority of the overlap is one of the crews goes home an hour before the other. It used to be like something closer to 3 hours, but everyone likes to be up early, apparently, except for me. We've got this split shift, but I've been continually investing in better, more automated equipment. Like I've said, you just picked up a machine, the exact same thing, a lathe with a bar feeder, live tools, all that stuff. Again, easiest way to print money without going to prison. And then with the horizontal, we've got these two Pearson horizontal pallet systems. So we can take our existing PPS fixtures that are typically on a vertical machine. We could put them on the face of a tombstone times four. And we have two of these times eight. And we get hours of, you know, lights out machining. It still is not there with the amount of production we get out of the bar fed lathes. Those go for days without stopping. If we can squeeze out 4 to 6 hours with having the air compressor on for three machines instead of two, it's a win. And we were talking about, we're losing one of our operators in at the beginning of June, Kyle. He's moving to the East Coast. We've known about it for a long time. And I go, wow, do we, instead of replacing a full-time guy, do we get another horizontal with a pallet pool and we throw six Pearson HPSs? And then, yes, and then we just go to a local shop and we advertise, hey man, who wants to pick up another hour or two of work after your existing job? And we'll pay you more than your overtime where you did. And all you do is the grunt work of unloading and loading and getting it ready for the night shift for the horizontals. And then you're good to go. Then you go home. And so, yeah, you put in your 9.5, 10.5 hours of work, but we paid you handsomely and that extended the run for another 6 hours, 8 hours for us. I think that's what we're going to do, because the culture is an issue. And I've been hesitant, first of all, going back to the talk of laying in the casket, but I don't want to take men and women outside of their home. I can't be at home with my children knowing that some employee is not with his children because they're building the profits of the company. It just doesn't sit right with me. So I don't want to do that, but if a guy's like, yeah, I usually get off at 5 and traffic stinks, I just want to work till 6:30. Great. Here are six horizontal pallets that you can change out. Let's do that. Might be a win-win all the way around.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Even the Speedio, the R tables. What are the R? No, the S.
450 and 650.
Okay. Are those the pallet changing ones?
Yes.
Yeah. Even those, it just makes sense. You don't have idle spindle time. Now, you can't have the density of a pallet pool with the horizontal, but it is just one more thing to extend your runtimes, lights out. So
yeah, and you can, if you put pallet bases or rotovices on them, mm-hmm. get a surprising amount of density per table mm-hmm. and have continuous spindle engagement. You're not going to get 6 hours of unattended time overnight.
Yeah.
But you can get significant amounts of walkaway time mm-hmm. during the day, because the difference between you need to be here every 15 minutes versus you need to check in on this machine once every 3 hours.
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally different.
Yeah. Yeah. That is true. That's true. Oh, did I tell you about the YouTube series we were planning on doing of like kind of the Gordon Ramsay, where I go in and help a shop turn around?
Hell's Kitchen style.
I can't remember if we talked about it offline.
No, you take two Lang vices, you smush some guy's face between them and say, are you an idiot sandwich?
What kind of donkey are you? So it's fun stuff. I think it would be fun content. Like our move series, it's not a huge YouTube hit, but it's fun content to follow along in a story. And so one of my contacts in the industry, he's a customer, and he picked up a job at a shop that was going to do kind of a turnaround where the owner had passed away and the son stepped in. The son didn't know much about manufacturing and it's just pulling his hair out. The deal ultimately fell through because the owner had too many hesitations, but we were going to go in there and I just evaluate and just say, yeah, my shop looked exactly like this. This is how we turn it around. Here are the principles. Here are our products. And I would even consider like giving the products to them so that they could turn around the company so that it's our contribution to telling a story and providing an example of how other manufacturers that don't have access to me go into their shop to do a turnaround, that they could just do the same thing. Go, oh, wow. Wow. They don't clean up at the end of the day because people just want to go home. Huh. Let's do that. All those little principles that you could see, not just me talking about it, but mm-hmm. people doing, and then a team, how they would react to it. So I'm kind of looking to still do that, but this was like in our neighboring city. I do want to do that where it's just within a 15, 20 minute drive and just the owner has to be on camera. I'm not going to be all Gordon Ramsay screaming and yelling, but
yeah, not quite John Taffer bar rescue.
Yes. Yeah.
Style. But so what actually at some point, I don't know when it was, I watched like a 20 minute clip of John Taffer's bar rescue.
Okay.
And then YouTube was convinced that I wanted to see clips from that forever. Like, hey, John Taffer, hey, bar rescue.
Yeah.
And what was interesting to me is the kinds of things in a bad company
uh-huh.
are instantly recognizable
from the outside.
Like, it's just, okay, yeah. The place isn't clean.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
People are not engaging with customers.
Yep.
It's not responsive or timely. Mm-hmm. There's just everything is disconnected. Everything is slow. Mm-hmm. Everything is weird. And the thing that I recall him saying repeatedly to owners is, you don't respect your employees and you don't respect your customers if you're letting this whole thing run this way.
Yeah.
And there's a whole bunch of like, fireworks and drama and made for TV.
Sure.
But in a fundamental way, if you run a company and you don't respect your employees mm-hmm. and you don't respect your customers, that's a 5-alarm fire. You have a huge problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was the case in this company. And ultimately, the deal fell through because he canned my contact. Because he said, you're being a little too decisive. I don't like the speed at which you want to turn this place around. You're not running enough decisions by me. And he's like, I decided to clean the floors behind the machine because it's a hazard and it's sticky. That's a terrible working environment. I don't know. I still want to do the same concept because I have more and more kind of margin and free time that I want to purpose towards something of value for the machining industry.
I look forward to hearing more about that, but I don't think that you have, as much as you have rock star hair, I don't think you quite have Gordon Ramsay rock star hair. You need a lot more product to get that whole upward quaff.
I could grow it out a bit if that makes
a faux hawk
tune in. Yeah.
Jay Faux Hawk Pearson.
You know what's funny? I don't think it'd get wide adoption because I'm not angry enough. It's not sensational enough. That's one of the things that sells on reality TV. It's like the screaming and yelling, and that's just not going to happen. But yeah, I still want to do it. I still really want to do it. I think that'd be really fun.
Okay.
Yeah.
I will watch it when you produce it.
Okay.
That'll be fun.
I just need shops to volunteer. You know, it would take a humble owner that says, hey man, I think we could be better. And I feel like I'm at my wit's end or I got too much going on. I just need someone to step in and just help out and just show me the things. That's what it would take. The owner of this company came and toured the shop and he said, I pitched it to him. He's like, yeah, great. I love it. Don't put me on camera. And I'm like, oh, that's part of the deal. And he goes, I don't know if that's going to happen. And I go, all right, maybe we can work around that. But I'm glad it fell through because at the end, I would be, you know, halfway through helping someone with no content to show for it. So,
yeah, that's not great.
You really want people that are willing to change and excited to change or desperate to change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Machine shop intervention.
Yeah. Yeah. Should ask ChatGPT to create a title, really catchy title. So anyways.
What would that title be? Feed hold. E-stop. E-stop.
E-stop.
All right. E-stop adventures. Jay Pearson.
That's good. We'll come up with the title next week.
I mentioned Culture Index earlier. Mm-hmm. The site is cultureindex.com.
Easy.
And the idea is analytics over instincts. What I've found about this that's been helpful to me is there are certain kinds of things you can identify about a person's personality and the way they like to work that can help you pre-screen to make sure you don't put somebody in a wildly wrong seat. Mm. This is not primarily you have specific things you want done, and this tells you the ultimate candidate for them. Mm-hmm. But you can screen people and say, hey, here's what we need. And that would be a very counterproductive fit mm-hmm. for this person mm-hmm. because of their personality and their work style and their willingness to take initiative or deal with ambiguity or a whole range of things. Mm-hmm. So it's mostly a screen, in my experience, to help recognize and avoid wrongly selecting a person and setting them up in a position where they are unlikely to succeed mm-hmm. because what you've given them to do runs completely counter mm-hmm. to their grain and personality.
Yep. And then it becomes they're at work, but they're frustrated with work. They're frustrated with you.
Yeah.
And you and I are not immune to this, but it's often a reaction of humans to take that inner a turmoil and try and place it on an element that, oh, that's why I'm angry because yeah. this guy's a jerk or whatever. When it's really not that, it's just you're functioning outside of your nature. You should not be doing yeah. this. Yeah.
The only person that I'm allowed to set up for failure is me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There you go. Extreme ownership. Ugh. I like that. Yeah.
Even me setting myself up for failure is not good. And being honest with myself and saying, hey, I'm not equipped to succeed at this or that thing. Mm-hmm. As the owner saying, hey, guys, I can't do this job. It's not going to go well.
Yep.
I'm not going to get done in a timely way. It's going to be prohibitively costly of energy for me. It's going to be a hot mess.
Yeah.
I should not put myself in that chair. Obviously, the buck stops with me. Mm-hmm. If push comes to shove and it has to get done, I'm the person who has to stay and do it.
Yeah.
That's my commitment as the owner. Mm-hmm. But that does not mean that putting myself in a seat that's obviously a poor fit for me mm-hmm. becomes a fine idea.
Yeah.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
Hey, have you ever run across that show? I think it's called Undercover Billionaire. Where they,
yeah.
Yeah. You know what was one of the standouts, at least the handful of episodes that I watched, was that they were not competent in the little micro things, but what they were really good at was going out and finding people that could do competent work. Like one guy, I think he was in one of the cities along the northern coast of shores of Ohio. Ugh, I can't remember now. But he went out and he found a bar owner, a cook, a real estate guy, an interior designer, and I think they set up a bar or a brewery. He just put these people together and pitched the vision to them, and they're like, yeah, I'll work for free. Let's give it a shot. And the goal is to create $1 million company in 30 days or 90 days or something like that. I don't remember the premise. But one of the things that stands out is they know their limitations and they know their strengths, and they lean into their strengths with everything they got. When they need to, yeah, paint a wall or something, they're there to help out, but they're best spent doing what they do best. And that is something that is not often. Like you and I, it's like, ah, I could, you know what? They screwed up. Yeah, just go home. I'll fix it. That's a natural inclination. The right thing is, you know what? Go home. We'll all get a good night's sleep. We'll come back together. I'll set you up so this doesn't happen again. We'll go through it. We'll document it. We'll create, like in here in our company, we create flow charts. So anyone can come in on the street, come off of the street mm-hmm. and just do the same work competently, building out the processes rather than here, let me do it. Because that's not scalable.